zig and I got a zag. Scientific revolution. Truly revolutionary. Whole new perception of reality. Perception of reality that derives from observation. Figuring out the way things actually work. Drafting mathematical rules that can show not only the process, but can be replicated by others. And if it can be replicated over and over again and you get the same result, suddenly that becomes a rule, a law of nature. In order to get from the view that everything was controlled by God and that Earth was different than what it was up in the heavens, it took over 100+ years, and it still continued to evolve even after there were people willing to accept these new ideas. But there was still resistance. Case in point, what happened to Galileo? But this movement towards knowledge would persist, and ultimately it would culminate with the works of Sir Isaac Newton. Newton pretty much was the scientist that put all doubt, all speculation to rest, because he filled in all of the gaps. He was British, actually English to be precise. Why is this not clicking? Oh, because I have to turn the on button on. There we go. But he was a mathematician, he was a physicist, he was an astronomer. His life work was aimed at synthesizing the mathematical precision of Kepler with the observations of Galileo. And in doing so, he brought a new single view of the way things work. And he wrote books and published them. 1687, he wrote Principia Mathematica. 1704, he wrote Optics. Every single finding he documented, came up with equations, and published to allow others to either prove him right or to prove him wrong. But when you look at the totality of his works, he essentially was arguing for this new perception of this world in which we inhabit. He said, no, the universe, reality, isn't just limited to the Earth, but rather the cosmos, which the Earth is part of, is infinite. It just goes on and on and on beyond the ability of humans to see. And that everywhere, this vastness, was governed by laws. Laws that could, as I said, be hammered down to mathematical equations. And that these laws control nature. It's not an unknowing, omnipotent force. No, it's just the rules of the game. It's way the reality operates. And he proved it. He proved it. One of his most famous experiments is when he took light itself and broke it apart into smaller components. Things that we don't see. When our eyes are open, we just see these images that kind of burn into our brain. But we don't realize that even light itself is made up of the different colors of the prism.
So he took a chunk of glass, cut it into a prism, and shined a light through.
And boom, what happens? Out comes the spectrum.
He realized that light travels in waves. And if you change the angle of the prism, you can get wider beams. And if you can break apart life itself, light itself, what also could you essentially take apart? In the end, he was developing an entire new philosophy of nature. Because he was trying to explain to the best he could, essentially, the structure of the universe itself. He proved that the Greek atomicists that started thinking this stuff back in 800 and 700 BC were correct. Everything, even light, is made up of smaller particles. Matter. And that matter is always there. Sure, you could burn it. You could crush it. You could, I don't know, blow it up. But the matter is still there. It's still there. But the way the matter is arranged, that's what determines what's alive and what's not. So yes, you have carbon in you. Your desk that you're sitting at has carbon. Why can you listen to me babble and the desk can't? No. The way your matter is arranged generates enough electricity of a spark to keep you alive. Questions? Yes.
What was Newton's book published in 1687?
1687. That was Principia Mathematica, the principle of mathematics.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. There are sections of that in the extra credit reader if you're curious. He also developed the laws of motion. So universally true in all circumstances. Newton's first law. Ready? Newton's first law, right there. A body at rest stays at rest. Until what? Until acted on by a force. What sport do you play? You must be a lineman. Acceleration. The more force you put on something, the faster it goes. And inversely, the less force you put on something, the slower it goes. And then my favorite, his third law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So true. If you come to class and take good notes and study, you will do well on the final. If you come to class and watch TikTok videos and daydream and take no notes, you will fail the final. Action, reaction. It's amazing. It's true in everything. And by the way, doesn't matter how big something is, how small something is. It could be we could be talking about the moon. It could be we're talking about a little dust of sand. It's true everywhere across the board. All right, well, if things are moving, propelling through space, what stops them from just shooting into the oblivion? Newton was also the first one to formalize what he called universal gravitation. He said what stops matter from just blowing apart is that every object is attracted to other objects. And that attraction keeps things together. But it's not strong enough like a magnet where you're locked together. It's just enough. Newton ultimately would pave the way by laying these foundations, these formulas, for every single scientist who have come after him to build upon. And think about the complexities that we understand now compared to what they understood then. It's all because people were willing to stop, observe, document. Try to explain, try to repeat. It was game-changing. Questions? Now here's the kicker. All of these guys were, I guess you could say, a little nerdy. All that they did was stay in laboratories, stay in observatories, and just experiment. They were not natural salesmen. So in order for these ideas to break through, you had to have people other than the scientists advocating for this new science. And some of the advocates were almost as important as the scientists themselves because of the way society was. Yes, the kings were breaking away from the authority of the church. The kings were going out and doing their more stuff. In France, the kings were centralizing their power. In England, well, they were kind of screwing things up and resulting in a constitutional monarchy. We talked about all that. Age of exploration. We talked about all that. But for the average person, it was still, what does the Bible say? What does the church say? What does my priest say? That was where they got their reality. The only way to shatter that hold was from people going on to the tops of the mountain and saying, hey, this science stuff is cool. There were hundreds of them. But I'm going to give you an example of one that was in the church, one that was in government, and one that was in academia. The first was one of the first advocates for studying science and the importance of this new attempt to better understand the universe. And that was Giordano Bruno. Unlike the other gentleman that we just talked about, he was not a mathematician. He was not an astronomer. What he was a Dominican monk. The primary job of the Dominican monks, that order, during his lifetime, was to work in the scriptorias. His order got all the books that were banned, copied them into Latin, and archived them to get them out of the public view. But he was a free thinker. He didn't believe something just because someone told him he had to believe it. Instead, he thought for himself. And he had a tendency to read the books that were forbidden by the church. For example, have any of you ever heard of Arianism? It doesn't have the why. We're not talking the Nazi stuff. Anybody? What is it? Do you remember? If not, it's okay.
No.
Okay. Arianus was a bishop in Alexandria. He was alive, I believe, in like the 3rd century AD. And he wrote several treatises talking about the nature of Christ. Arianus essentially would come to argue that Jesus is different than God. Why? Jesus was a created living being. And the moment he was born onto the Virgin Mary, substantively, he was no longer one of the Father. He was a different substance. Jesus walked the earth. Jesus could be tapped on the arm. You people who were alive could see him. They could hear him. They could speak with him. God, on the other hand, is the Alpha and the Omega. God is the everything and the nothing. But when you put the two together, they are emphatically different. Compare that to the position of the Catholic Church, which embraces the Holy Trinity. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. All one in the same. All co-equal. Well, that was the official position of the church. And back in the time of the Emperor Constantine, when they gathered at Nicaea and had a council and enacted what would become known as the Nicene Creed, this was outlawed. This was declared heresy. And it took the church many centuries to burn this idea out. But Bruno went into a church vault, pulled out some dusty scrolls, sat back and started reading it and said, huh, that's kind of logical. No? He got himself into a lot of trouble. He also was caught with Textus Receptus. He was alive around the time, shortly thereafter, Erasmus. And Erasmus put the two copies, the Latin and the Greek. And Erasmus wasn't saying that the church was necessarily wrong. He was just asking questions. And Bruno started saying, yeah, it makes sense. Because after all, if we're going to be true Christians, should we not be doing it right? And how do we know if we're doing it right? Well, we have to question. And the church did not like it. But he did not stop. Because lo and behold, when he would get his hand on a copy of Copernicus's book and read about the heliocentric universe, he started arguing and advocating with his fellow monks that if this is the way the galaxy actually works, this is the way God intended it. Should we not be changing the rules of the church to reflect nature as God created it? Well, when he was challenged, because this is what the church says, he simply replied, have you ever gone out into a field and just stood still? What can you feel on any given day? Any of you ever go out in the middle of a field and just stand still? Close your eyes? What do you always feel?
Depressed.
What?
Depressed.
Depressed?
Yeah.
Why? Don't you like being one with nature? Dude, I'm sorry.
The wind.
You feel the wind. Okay. Copernicus is saying the Earth's moving around the sun. We all can feel the wind, can we not? What happens when you're driving down the road and stick your head out the window? What do you feel? The wind. Plus, what happens when you look up? What can you see? You can see the clouds going by. So he basically said, don't tell me that the Earth is static. When you can see it, you can feel it just by standing still. And as if that didn't get him into enough trouble, this one got him even into more trouble. He was the first one before Newton to actually put in writing the notion that there is much more to the universe than we can see. It goes on and on and on. Right? Okay. And he also theorized. See all those little lights up in the sky? Chances are those are suns like our sun. And if they're suns like our suns, chances are they probably have planets going around them. And if they have planets going around them like ours, maybe they have life too. As he said, if these planets contain animals and inhabitants, this could have a detrimental effect on the position of the church. Because does not the Old Testament in the book of Genesis say that God created the earth and all life on it? And he created man to rule over his earthly kingdom? What if there's also E.T.? You ever see E.T.? Classic 80s movie. What if on those other planets there are beings like E.T.? Did God create them? And if God created them, who's really in God's image? No big deal to us today, but this was outright heretical in his day. Because the more he thought, the more he wrote his words down on paper, the more he began advocating within the church to transform religion itself. Gone should be the supposed miracles contained in Scripture. Instead, there should be the ability of mankind to worship nature as God created it. Because what more proof do you want of the brilliance of God than looking at a flower or looking at a llama? Llamas are proof that God exists. He didn't say that. That's my opinion. But, unfortunately, 1592, word gets out to the Holy Office of what this monk is not only writing, but also preaching. He is arrested in Venice, transferred to Rome, and he stands trial. For 7 years, hearing after hearing, he is given the opportunity to recant, to take back all that you said, and he refused. He believed what he believed to be the God's honest truth. And if you believe God's truth, how is that heresy? When, after 7 years, he refused to recant, Pope Clement VIII would declare him to be a heretic. And on February 17th, 1600, on Ash Wednesday, he would be sentenced to death. He first would be muzzled. They cut his tongue out of his mouth because of his wicked words. He was then hung upside down and burned at the stake. Why upside down? So he could suffer punishments for impure thoughts. And they burned him not just once. They burned him not just twice. They burned him thrice. They picked up all his ashes and dumped it in the Tiber River. So he would not be a martyr. But the truth be told, when word of what happened to Bruno, now we're not talking the 1300s, we're talking 1600. When word of what the church did to him began spreading, people, particularly in the Protestant parts, started saying, maybe the church isn't all that it's cracked up to be. If the church cannot withstand questions, possibilities, who is the actual advocate for truth? Questions. Any of you willing to be burned at the stake for your beliefs? All right. Eventually the church would get it. And by the 19th century, or actually the 18th century, the church began allowing those banned books to be published and to be circulated, and the church pretty much got itself out of the science business. What about government? Well, interestingly enough, one of the first governments to embrace this scientific possibility was England. During the reign of James I, the Lord Chancellor, today we would call him the Prime Minister for England, was Lord Francis Bacon. In government, he would be one of the first people basically arguing for the political and economic possibilities of science. Because after all, if you could embrace science and you could figure out some new technique, you could change the economy of your country. And you could improve the lives of your inhabitants. But he was also wary of the dark side of science. Because for every advancement that helps somebody, you could easily make something new that could hurt people. So he was one of the first people to attempt to devise a scientific methodology, rules by which all scientists should follow. Today, we know this as empiricism. He basically argued for the scientific method. So, first, you come up with a hypothesis. Then, you engage in observation. Then, when you kind of think you got it down, then you document it. And go back to step one, repeat. Redo it.
and see if you get the same result. If you get the same result multiple times, then you publish it. You allow other people to try it. And if the same results happen over and over and over again, then you establish scientific fact. Ultimately, through this inductive process, focused on essentially observation first and foremost, that's ultimately how you would push the needle. But there's dangers in this. As I said, there's a dark side. The challenge with changing perception boils down to what Lord Francis Bacon referred to as the idols. As in the biblical false idols. You ready? Idol number one. Idol number one, he referred to as idols of the tribe. Idols of the tribe. Idols of the tribe. He argued that there are certain, well, he used the word race, but by race he meant culture. There are some cultures out there that embrace falsehoods as truths. So, for example, think of a primitive tribe that lives in some rainforest somewhere. Chances are they're making sacrifices to the rain god, either to get more rain or not enough. And if you really want to go crazy, look at what the Aztecs did. You know how the Aztecs appeased the rain god? What? No! No! They believed that their rain god could only be satiated through the tears of children. So what you do is you take the child up to the top of the pyramid along with their parents, and you strap mom and dad down and you cut open their chest and pull out their heart. And as the kid freaks out and starts to cry, the rain god laps their tears. Now, I don't know about you, although I'll be honest with you, this may sound really weird. I honestly don't remember the last time I actually cried. But I'm sure as I was a kid, I probably cried at some point. But when I cry, I don't remember the weather changing. But yet, that was an absolute truth that the Aztec believed. So that would be an example of an idol of the tribe. Question on that idol. Idol number two. Idol of the den. Idols of the den, or idol of the den. A den, of course, being your home turf. Bacon argued that there are individuals that believe falsehoods. No matter how much you try showing them they're wrong, doesn't matter. You'll never convince them.
Do I want to be controversial? All right, I will.
And I'm not doing this to be offensive. I'm just kind of saying it as a scientific and a biological fact. Men do not have babies. But yet there are people who say yes, they do. Unfortunately, they are victims of idols of the dead. I could come up with so many more, but I won't. Number three, idols of the marketplace. Idols of the marketplace. Idols of the marketplace. There are falsehoods that are spread through the misuse of language. This may be shocking to some of you. There are people that are out there that have agendas. And in order for them to propagate their agenda, they intentionally use little white lies.
Well, it became very popular to refer to it as fake news.
And why do they propagate these false words? Well, they want to score victory. They want to have an advantage. They want to push their agenda. FYI, in case you're not aware, you could put on the TV and go to a quote-unquote news broadcast, and no matter what channel you're watching, be it a liberal or a conservative, there is no legal requirement that they actually tell the truth. But rather, what the news is set up to do is to preach to echo chambers. So conservative people tend to go to Fox News. And so what does Fox News say? Well, they give you the conservative spin. But then there are people who are liberals. And so they'll go to, like, MSNBC. And what will they do? They'll only propagate that liberal echo chamber. It's not the truth. But they do it because they know we as human beings only like hearing the things that we agree with. It makes us feel validated. But you know why Fox News and MSNBC and CNN, oh, they do that? It's all about advertising dollars. If you can get 5 million conservatives watching a broadcast on Fox News, they're going to be able to turn around to the advertisers and say, look, I can guarantee you there are going to be 5 million sets of eyes on our TV at any given point, and you give me this amount of money, we will advertise your product. And the liberals do the same thing. But yet, how many people sit back and say, well, I saw it on the news, it must be true. So not only are you victim of the idols of the marketplace, but then you become victim of the idols of the den. Why does it occur?
Idol number four. Idols of the theater. Idols of the theater. Idols of the theater. There are people in power that push the falsehoods so they can stay in power.
Not only do certain cultures embrace falsehoods, not only do individuals embrace falsehoods, not only are there falsehoods out there because people don't use English precisely, but you actually have politicians who lie. Why do they lie? Well, in our country, they get into power through elections. And they know they need 50% plus one vote to stay in their cushy jobs that aren't really jobs. So if they can tell enough lies and they can convince enough people, they can get that 50% of the votes plus one. They have no interest in telling you the truth. Democrats and Republicans. So, Bacon essentially argued because of that, getting actual truth out is difficult. It is difficult. Because people can't handle the truth. But he argued that's all scientists should be focused on. If you're going to claim to be a scientist, you must focus on obtaining just the facts. And if people don't believe it to be true, that's on them, not on you. Because the worst thing is someone claiming to be a scientist and then propagates lies. It's my last controversial example. Dr. Anthony Fauci. Do you remember all of the BS that was heaved out during the COVIDs? Oh, remember when he first said, oh, you're not going to get the COVIDs, don't wear a mask. And then suddenly said, no, you must wear a mask. And you wear a cloth mask. You put a bandana over your mouth and you won't get the COVIDs. And then a few weeks later, no, that's not true. No, that's not true. You can't wear the cloth masks. You only can wear the medical masks, the surgical masks. And they said, no. The surgical masks now are not true. Now you have to wear those N95 masks. Oh, wait. That's not true either. Now you have to wear two masks. And then he said things like, oh, social distancing. You have to stay 6 feet apart. Oh, you can't congregate with people. Because if you put too many people into a tight space, you're all going to get the COVID. And then it continued. Oh, you can't go outside without wearing a mask, even if you're by yourself, because you could get the COVID. My favorite was a rule that was put in place for a few weeks in Massachusetts. You could not be in your car after 10 p.m. Or you could actually be pulled over by the police because COVID only comes out at 10 p.m. You also could not go into the little mom and pop stores because that's where COVID is. Oh, but you could go to Home Depot and Walmart because there is no Home Depot and Walmart. So long as you follow those little arrows that said walk this way. Remember, you only could go up one way in the aisle. You know, it was a fun game, walking against the flow. You'd see people's eyes bug out. Or like when I would go in the store without wearing a mask, you could see the absolute terror in their fears. I had fun with it. Oh, remember when they said also, if you get the jab, you won't get the COVIDs? Until people who were getting the jab suddenly got, you know, I never had the COVID until after I was forced to teach here to get the jab. Then I got the COVID. Even though they said you get the jab, you won't. But when they started saying, oh, you won't get the COVIDs if you continue to get the jab and the jab and the jab, that's when I was like, no, I'm done. All of that stuff was not science, as was admitted by Anthony Fauci on the stand before Congress. He basically didn't know what was going on and he was making it all up as he went along. But yet, do you still see the people every now and then driving on the highway all by themselves in the car wearing a mask? That is the power of idols of the theater. There are people who will believe anything. And that's a danger. So, The only way to counter it
is to have science be open and free. By the way, while all Fauci was pushing all his stuff, there were actual medical specialists trying to refute everything that he was saying, but our government went in and shut them down. No, if he was really trying to figure out a solution to this plandemic, they would have wanted all of the scientists in the country to be experimenting and trying to figure out solutions. But they didn't. They shut it all down because of their agenda. Because true science, you got to let everyone participate. Because that's the only way to figure out the truth. It has to be free. You can't fear retribution by the government. And by the way, you should not be using science for the dark side. Gain of function. Remember that phrase, gain of function. COVID was a biological weapon that was basically scaled up in a lab. Why on earth would you take a common cold virus and make it so it could kill people? No, that's not science. That's terrorism. And as long as all the scientists play by the same rules, the possibilities of scientists, science is limited. Questions. By the way, don't believe anything I say. Use your little Google machines and look stuff up. It's amazing what's out there. One of the last significant things that Bacon called for was essentially the only way to break through was to radically revolutionize the education system. Because the problem with academia is most academics think they know everything and think they tell the truth. But if they are propagating falsehoods, then they're not. So he called for a destruction of the existing education system and wanted to create a diverse forum when people of all opinions and all perspectives could have the ability to contribute. And the example that I'm going to use of the person who pushed for education reform within education is René Descartes. Descartes was a philosopher, he was a mathematician, he was a scientist, but he also taught in the University of Paris. And he saw with his own eyes the so-called academics were not teaching anything that was real. So, if people were saying all of these falsities, how can you figure out what is the actual truth? Well, the first thing that he would do is he would do self-reflection. He would look into his own perspectives and he would try to figure out, okay, what is it that I believe is fact versus what is it that I believe that is opinion? Are there situations where I believe that opinion is fact? And if I believe that opinion is fact, is it the truth? He suddenly realized, I don't think I know anything. And then he looked around. And he
realized that the education system in the 17th century when he was alive was basically worthless. All of the prominent universities, all of the faculty primarily was made up of Jesuit priests, and all the Jesuit priests taught about was basically us trying to establish whether or not God existed. Well, he realized, why am I going to spend my whole life trying to figure out whether or not God exists? What's the point of that? It's irrelevant. It's meaningless. Why? Well, very simple. There's no need to try to prove whether or not God exists because existence wouldn't exist without a creator. Because when was the last time you had something that came from nothing? No. Everything you have in your life came from someone or somewhere or something. Now, what is the nature of God? It doesn't matter. All we need to know is that we exist because of, at some point, creation occurred. Now, the when, the how, we're never going to know, so why are we going to waste our time? Just accept it. We exist. And how could he prove that he existed? Very simple. I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. He realized, the only thing that he could prove was his own existence. And he knew he could prove his existence because he was thinking about his existence. And he had doubt about his existence. If you did not exist, you could not think that you exist. Nor could you doubt your very existence. Once you get over that, it's soon easy to figure out what you don't know. And why are you going to waste your time trying to know things that you already do know? No, you should be spending your time trying to figure out things you don't. Because if human beings would stop wasting their time worrying about things that they have no control over and instead redirected those energies on trying to figure out things they don't know, think about what could be achieved. Bless you. And why are you going to waste your time learning things? Well, knowledge is power. Knowledge is power. If I know more than you, I could essentially become the master. And I could possess anything that I set my sights on. But ultimately, the focus should only be on the truth. Questions. Again, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of other advocates that were alive during the 17th and 18th centuries. Ben Franklin, being an American example. We just don't have time to talk about them all. No questions?
We got it all down? It's gonna go black.
Whoa.
It's amazing how I knew that was coming. It's almost like I wrote the class. Go figure. So now what's the significance of all this stuff? Well, if you're going to begin trying to figure out the way the world works, trying to figure out these rules, these laws of nature, what happens if you start applying those standards to different sectors of existence? At the same time these scientists are trying to figure out the way the world works, at the same time as people are advocating to embrace this new methodology, life itself in Europe would radically change. And it began with the production of the commodities necessary for life itself. Beginning in the 1700s, farmers started experimenting with food production. Not just agriculture, but also with livestock. But I'll tell you, this was crazy insane. Why? Well, for an important reason. Tradition. Now, traditionally, sorry, I'm going to make money. Traditionally, life itself was tied to harvests. If there was a good harvest, there was more food, which meant there would be more food in people's bellies, which meant there's chances are going to be more people that survive life itself. But when famines hit, food production plummets, people get sick, and they die. So, going back to time immemorial, messing with food was a risk. Because what happens if you screwed it up? You're dead. Anyone want to play that type of gamble? Plus, the economies were tied to agriculture. Before the development of cash markets, commodities were exchanged, traded, bartered. We talked about mercantilism. Tons of agricultural products came in, and they would trade for other commodities. So if there was a bad harvest, you had depressions, you had recessions, you had unemployment. Plus the whole supply side, economics of capitalism. Lower the supply, higher the price. Higher the price, less people can afford to buy food. Which of course means famine, disease, death. So people were absolutely terrified and would refuse to risk it. That was until Mother Nature made experimentation possible. As we know, around the time of the bubonic plague, Europe and the whole world got hit with a global temperature shift known as the Little Ice Age. Global temperatures plummeted. But
during the 16th and into the 17th century, so the late 1500s into the early 1600s, temperatures kind of increased. Not much. They only went up about a half a degree Celsius from the low, which was about 8 degrees Celsius below average. But this little increase, a half of a degree, basically provided better weather. And what can you do if you have better weather in terms of food production? You have longer growing seasons. You have less water, which means you can produce more. Coincidentally, during this same time, there was the importation of New World plants. Potatoes, in particular, tomatoes, and so many other agricultural items that were only found in the New World that were brought back to Europe and would become infused into the agricultural system. So as there were more options available, people's diets changed. During the Middle Ages, they primarily ate grain. You had porridge, you had bread. Maybe you had some dairy, so you had some milk, you had some cheese. And if you live near the coast, maybe you got a little fish. And maybe every now and then you got a little bit of meat. But that was about it. But suddenly, at some point, we don't know exactly when it started, but from the 16th into the 17th century, these New World crops were being planted in Europe. They found places they could grow, and people started switching over to what today we would call more of a balanced diet, where you had fresh produce that could be added in. So in addition to potatoes and tomatoes, you have different types of beans. You had corn, you had peanuts, you had sunflower seeds and rice and other supplementals. FYI, the most significant import, the game changer, was the potato. The potato originally was domesticated in Peru. And it came across in the transatlantic trade system. And they found it grew really well in Spain as well as Ireland. While the Irish and the Spanish were quick to embrace it, a lot of other people in Europe were not, because they viewed a potato as a dirty root, because literally it grows in the ground. But in places that grew the potatoes, they saw more food available for their populations. FYI, 1 acre of potatoes, just 1 acre, can feed 10 people for a year. Whereas 1 acre of wheat could feed 6 people for a year. So if you got rid of the wheat and planted potatoes, suddenly you're feeding more people. You can support a larger population. Why? Because people who are sick have a tendency to die. And also have a tendency not to reproduce. And babies that are born sick from sick parents also have a tendency to die. But if you have expanded diets, more nutrients are getting into mom and dad, baby, odds are, is going to come out, have those nutrients in them, and they'll be better off able to live. And coincidentally, it would trigger a huge population boom in Europe. 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, it's estimated that the total European population from England all the way to Russia was about 50 million. But by 1800, it was nearly 200 million.
And what explains it? Food.
Women were able to marry earlier. The younger that a girl gets married, the larger the window she has to produce babies. Simultaneously, infant mortality rates would decline. In 1500, every pregnancy had a 50% chance of producing a viable child that made it to age one. Well, the other side of that is mean that 50% of pregnancies would result in either a miscarriage, a dead birth, or the child would be dead before age one. Think of what happened to Queen Catherine of England. Well, more food, women marry early, kids are healthier, life expectancy increased. Oh, thank God, because in 1500, the average age was 35 years old. I would be ancient. It did not increase until 50, until 1900. Oh, and by the way, it also impacted more and more and more. The more people that were born alive, that meant the more men you could put guns in their hands and fight the wars. But here's the catch. In order for change to occur, you had to have the people who owned the land be willing to embrace the change. And change is risky. But lo and behold, there were some landlords that were willing to take the risk, because if they succeeded, they could make more money. The first people to take the risk on a large scale were the Dutch. The Dutch, because much of the Netherlands is below sea level, had a water table problem. Much of their farmland was too wet to grow crops. So they worked hard for about 100 years and they revolutionized irrigation systems. That's the reason why the picturesque stereotypical Dutch windmill, what that exists is to be a pump to basically pump the water out. They dug, you know, culverts in canals and streams. They dug them deep to try to get a way to catch the water that was below the mud level. By the way, when they did this, they expanded their farmland over the course of 100 years by about 20%. 20% more acres to grow more food. They also were the first people not to overplant their fields. They would attempt to leave some fields fallow, meaning unplanted. And when they did so, things like clover grew. But also sometimes they would plant turnips. What they accidentally discovered was that these two little crops add nutrients to the soil. They just don't drain it. So if you allow a portion of your field to just remain untouched for a year and you grow these things, next year when you go to plant it, better dirt, more food. But what the hell are you going to do with clovers and turnips? Any of you like turnips? No one likes really likes turnips. But you know who likes turnips and clovers? Cows. So you're going to give better food to the cows, and the cows are going to become healthier. Which means they're not only going to produce more milk and more calves,
but their meat is going to be better.
Oh, plus fertilizer. Supercharged poop
left in the fields, because you're not going to pull the clovers, you're just going to let the cow go eat it. So you got all these cow patties all around your field, and when it comes time to plant it, you simply till all the poop into the dirt. More nutrient-rich soils.
More food is produced.
Then the Brits would take those Dutch innovations and expand upon them.
Unlike in the Netherlands, where many of the farms were communal, in England, England practiced private property. So what the landlords started doing, as they tilled the soil and they pulled out all the rocks, they started making walls around their fields. So they knew exactly what was theirs and what was their neighbor's. Which meant you could plant, theoretically, all the way up to the wall if you wanted to. And you could maximize your acreage. And then you add the clovers and the turnips and the cows and all the rest. And suddenly, even if you only got an acre or two of land, you're able to produce two, three, four times as much as your great-great-grandfather could.
The Brits also developed a four-crop annual rotation system.
So instead of planting the same crop in all of your acreage, year after year after year, no, you would divide it into four. One quarter of your fields, you would plant your wheat. But then in another sector, you would put your clovers. Or you'd plant your turnips.
And then in the fourth quadrant, you would plant a winter crop, like barley.
Wheat, barley, clovers, turnips. And then guess what you do next year? You rotate. So this means you're only using one quarter of your fields to get your wheat crop. You use one quarter of your fields to get your barley crop. And essentially the other two quarters, you're recharging the soil. And because you're rotating it, you're never going to burn out the land. Because you can't make more land.
What happened in England was revolutionary, because the landlords realized we now need less labor. So we can kick all the peasants off the field. And we can make more money. And ultimately, that was the goal of the agricultural revolution. Greater efficiency. More crops per acre. By using less labor.
Questions. I got one more little blurb and then we're done. All right. So now you're making more, which means you're going to make more money. And you need less labor to do it. So you're kicking the people off the farms. Where are the people that are kicked off the farms going to go? What? Well, all the farmers start doing the same thing. Well, what's going to start happening is the countries that embrace these agricultural changes, you now have a surplus supply of labor that needs jobs. Two, the farmers start making so much money, they need some place to invest their money. Three, because they're making so much extra money, simply by just changing things up, they're waiting for the next innovation. And they're willing to give it a try. I just planted the seeds that would give rise to the Industrial Revolution, which we'll talk about. Today's Thursday, right?
Tuesday. Questions? All right. Tuesday. We do not have class on Thursday because it's Easter break. Then we come back for Tuesday, Thursday. Then I think we have a Tuesday, Thursday, then we have a final. The semester is almost done. Paper is due April 22nd. Final exam is, whenever the final exam is. I still can't remember what the damn test is, but you should know where it is by now. Yeah.
At the end of class. What? Should you look at this at the end of class?
Look at what?
A little bit of my paper.
Should I give them pointers? Let's play democracy. How many people say no? Come on, be honest here. We're all friends. You actually want me to give him an advantage grade-wise? I'm not doing it for all of you.
Fine. Come on. I'm done. Go ahead. Please. Dismissed.